Rupture, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. It's a pleasure for me to be here and also to acknowledge and honor my colleague, the Dean of Optometry at Ohio State University, that we've been friends for 4 years. And Mel, thank you also for devoting your past president time to One Health. We certainly appreciate that. So my topic is kind of back to the future. How do you merge One Health with public health? So my objectives in this short time would be to give you a brief history or background of the concept of One Health, literally back to the future, talk really quickly about some driving forces that make this concept relevant today, define kind of the global scale and scope and the principles of One Health, discuss some contemporary challenges that my colleagues will do, I think, a better job in more detail about One Health and the need to converge with public health, and then talk very briefly to end up about some recommendations about One Health and how we're actually doing. So it is back to the future. You can go back to the 18th century, and some of the greatest discoveries in the history of medicine and public health were really made at the intersection at that time of human and animal health. And frankly, we have reached a time where that's converging once again. We all know the story of Jenner and the protection of smallpox through cowpox back at that time, and also Louis Pasteur, really the time of the 19th century, looking at germ theory of disease, a French chemist that studied chicken cholera, but a lot of other things, and Robert Koch, the German physician who studied anthrax. And really, these were precursors to comparative medicine and really One Health back at that time. In addition, back in the 19th century, Rudolf Virchow, German physicist and pathologist, said, "Between animal and human medicine, there are no dividing lines, nor should there be." And he was the one that coined the term zoonoses. So if you look at that era, I think we really have come back again. Scientific knowledge has really exploded in the 20th century, in the early part of this century. And medicine has become increasingly specialized. And frankly, so did veterinary medicine. We have 43 specialties right now in veterinary medicine. And so these really sciences really took off and diverged. So as opposed to comparative medicine, I'm looking at animals and humans all together collectively. We're now at a time that this is really coming back. And some of the heroes, I think, late into the 20th century have been Jem Steele and Cal Schwabe. And I think it was about 30 years ago, really, that we really had an appreciation of this new era of emerging infectious diseases and the understanding that by far the greatest majority of human infections over the last three decades were from or through animals. And then we had an endorsement between both the American Veterinary Medical Association and the American Medical Association to start working together through the endorsement of One Health. And then we saw the emergence of One Health centers, whether they're in universities, federal agencies, state agencies, and international agencies. So as we moved into the 21st century, it's interesting to see these driving forces that I think really pushed us ahead into this One Health reemergence, if you will, are alive and well and probably accelerating. Our interconnectivity of the world, the great 20th and 21st century mixing bowl of people, animals, and animal products in an ever-changing environment. Globalization as people and animals and trade move. $12 trillion of trade, a quarter of which are through livestock and agriculture, are constantly moving around the world in speeds that we've never seen before. Fast population growth, dislocation of people that, again, are unprecedented during our time or any other time. Peri-urbanization, where a billion people now live in urban settings. Livestock 2020, which we'll talk about, was the new revolution in agriculture, a major increase in the number of animals to feed 7.5 billion people and moving forward. And the diasporas emerge as people move and relocate. Society's changes in culture are also changing worldwide. The human-animal interface is accelerating, intensifying. We live in a world of greater risk and greater scope and scale of the consequences of this risk. We really are at a time when there's a threat to human health, animal health, and environmental health, and the time has come that we can't look at these as separate entities any longer. I know you're going to hear from my colleagues about changing landscape, changing habitats, and the potential changes we see as we look at climate change over the next decades and even centuries and how that will actually impact and the need for One Health. The Institute of Medicine really talked about this era as a perfect microbial storm. the time in history where all the factors, whether they're genetic, biological, physical, ecological, social, political, have all come together and created a unique time where these factors have created a perfect microbial storm where we see two or three emerging infectious diseases every year on the average, and certainly more to come. And what we've really appreciate now is the concept of multi-host pathogens. In veterinary medicine, it was pretty common for us to take a look when you go on farms that animals and those pathogens moved across species lines pretty readily, and that was just how we were trained. And that was a concept of multi-host pathogens. And what we've learned over the last couple decades is that the multi-host pathogens are also what's causing human infections and human diseases. So the winners are those ecological generalists. The microbes such as retroviruses or coronaviruses or influenza viruses, RNA viruses at the human-animal interface that are moving, changing constantly that add, I think, to the concept of multi-host pathogens. And we know the rapid increase in human populations, but the red lines really demonstrate how fast those populations are growing in developing countries. So at least 90% of the world's population and the growth is attributed to the developing world. The areas that we really have a concern about in terms of their infrastructure and their ability to find new emerging diseases and certainly to respond to those. And the shift to these large megacities and how that is changing the threats of emerging infectious diseases as we move from urban to more to urban societies. The peri-urban areas are the confluence. We have 1 billion people, the fastest growing group of people on the planet now growing in these new peri-urban settings, right? So we had 10,000 new people to the face of the earth every hour. And if you think about the population and where the majority of that's going, it's going into the developing world and into these populations. So urbanization is really a phenomenon of the developing world, but it has created a whole new niche, if you will, for microbes. And what we don't see and what we're really starting to find out is the change in agriculture. Urbanization is changing agriculture, not only in moving agriculture and animal agriculture much closer to urban settings, but actually within urban settings, and how that becomes really the new focus, if you will, I think, for new emerging infectious diseases. So this is populations. If you want to have threats to the environment, the animals, and the people, these are certainly focal points to take a hard look at. International tourists, we all know that there's almost 1.5 billion people moving across international borders now every year, and that the pathogens move more rapidly than their incubation period. So while you can go to the airport and be stopped to not carry a knife on board airplanes, you can carry all kinds of viruses any place that you really need to go. And this is the super vector, right? We worry about mosquitoes and dengue and all kinds of problems, but this is also a huge worry as our world has become so mobile and moving around so quickly. And the same thing with our animals and animal products, frankly. And then there's the livestock 2020 revolution, which really came out of a study for the FAO that talked about the need to really revolutionize agriculture. And if you think about the revolution of the green revolution, that really was supply driven. The livestock revolution is demand driven. So the concept is 1 to 2 billion people gain in wealth as a relative term. One of the first things that happen in their lifestyle is that they demand food from animal protein sources. And that is going to greatly accelerate the number of animals grown in populations. And they're not going to be grown in Iowa, they're going to be grown around the world. And they're going to change the ecosystems, how those animals are grown. And I will tell you, in my opinion, greatly increase the threats. So last year, almost 40 billion billion food animals were produced to help feed a population of 7.5 billion people, resulting in trillions of pounds of produce distributed worldwide. Unprecedented. And this is changing as our population will move toward 9 billion by the middle of this century, and we'll have to almost double the number of animals produced to actually feed that growing demand. So what's going to happen with this globalization, with this mixing bowl of animals, people, and products, and the changing environment that's disrupted because of this phenomenon? And that's where One Health really has to be part of our future. This is a look at meat consumption by million metric tons. If you look at what has really happened versus 2020, which is a projection, the red line is the increase in meat consumption in the developing world. The blue is actually an increase in the developed world. So you can see, if you're in animal agriculture or in agriculture, that's pretty good news. But it has a downside to it. So that's a lot of Big Macs, as they would say. But lots of animals and people now and products mixing way that we've just never really seen before. And our ecosystems are changing. I know Peter will probably mention this and perhaps Jonna as they give their presentations. But we haven't done a really good job in our ecosystems as we change our habitats. We dam rivers. We change our environment and not for the better. And this is just a reminder to take a look at cases of West Nile by counties in the United States last year. And remember, this was 1999, the perfect microbial storm, the proper virus in the middle of New York City with all the susceptibles, with the right mosquito vectors in place. And people, first of all, was misdiagnosed, and secondly, people thought it would just stop. This is now part of the landscape of human medicine and diagnostics, and by the way, also in equine and in avian medicine, because these animals are also susceptible. It just reminds us how quickly then the world can change, and in this case, stayed that way. So for me, it goes back to my course in physics, right? Newton's third law of motion. It said, in essence, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And that's where we are in the world today. Our interconnectivity is you can't push one of those circles without pushing on the other or on two others. So we're at the time of scientifically, and I think in terms of public health, where you have to appreciate all of these domains at the same time and understand that many of the interventions for good public health really begin either in environmental health or animal health. So One Health, it's holistic, it's integrative, it's collaborative, it really is a new scientific niche, if you will, for health. It's an emphasis on multiple disciplines and professions. And there's this appreciation of the connectivity of these three domains as we move forward. The collaborative effort of multiple disciplines working locally, nationally, and globally to attain optimal health of humans, animals, and the environment. And it has really started back to the future, if you will, of what we saw really early on a couple centuries ago. So this is not relative just to this country. Matter of fact, I think One Health is even more of a factor overseas. So if you took a look at this little girl, she's really representative of a population of almost a billion people, small livestock keepers, if you will, who really life depends on their interactions and the health of the very animals that are part of their lives. 70% of the rural poor, 30% of the urban poor depend on livestock. And a study that was out just a year or so ago from ILRI, the International Livestock Research Institute in Nairobi, Kenya, said when they looked at 56 zoonotic diseases globally, they believe they're responsible for 2.5 billion cases of human illness and 2.7 million deaths annually. And we get pretty excited about MERS at about 200 cases. That's an epidemic. 2.5 billion. And that is about One Health. And we're certainly one of do more in terms of HIV and tuberculosis and malaria. But look at those statistics and think, what are we going to need to do with this population worldwide, the bottom 1 billion whose lives are impacted by these zoonotic diseases? Massive underreporting of these diseases. And if you just take a look of where these diseases are occurring, they're occurring in the poorest parts of the world, and they are in part responsible for poverty. And as you flip that around, part of the alleviation of poverty will also, I think, be a responsibility of what we do in One Health. So as I go overseas to many countries, I find out that sometimes agriculture people and public health people and environmentalists and finance ministers don't talk to one another. And so we have this real problem that for many zoonoses, it's the risk to human health that's the most important. But the most effective control is in animals. And we need to not only appreciate that, we need to devise new interventions and new strategies as we go forward. So let me just end on this one, not such a negative note, but just to tell you what the threat is. But there are things that are being done that can be done, I think, that will make our future much more attractive. Josh Lederberg, a Nobel laureate, really kind of helped kick this off in the Institute of Medicine. We talked about it's our wits versus their genes, and a book that was really a seminal publication on microbial threats to health, a call to action, looking at the factors that I talked about earlier, this convergence model of people, animals, and the factors that are moving together, the global scale of these problems, the recognition of ecology of diseases, not to mention bioterrorism, and did I tell you that 80% of the select agents are also zoonotic? And what we see then is a number of recommendations out of the Institute of Medicine in 20 different publications, resulting in 50 different recommendations from the Institute of Medicine. The scientific rationale of One Health and what needs to be done, and these are just a few of the publications that have come out in the last decade that have talked about One Health, its focus, and the needs as we moved into the future. And if you look at kind of a consensus of putting all those together in terms of a meta-study, it's about improving infrastructures, not only in human health, but in animal health, because they're related. And we know as the future moves forward that the bottom 1 billion has to have an infrastructure in both, to integrate our surveillance and diagnostic systems, to increase investments in research and development, to spend more time about focusing and developing an infectious disease workforce that's able to work collectively across professional lines, looking at this globally, creating some emerging infectious disease centers, and improving the understanding of the public and meeting, I think, critical needs. So let's just kind of end with where we are. Recommendations, I think, to take a look at kind of the scorecard. So we're kind of told what we ought to do. Now, how are we actually doing as we move forward? So how are we doing in enhancing global response capacity? I think we're doing pretty positive. That would be a green light. We kind of learned our lesson with influenza, with SARS, et cetera, as we kind of move forward, and I think we've done well. Improving infectious disease surveillance, kind of flatlined. In some cases, I think we've done a good job. In others, really not so good. How about it rebuilding the public health capacity? And the answer of that, I think, is negative. Really are not keeping up with the changes, with the needs, I think, for this capacity as we move into the future. And looking at surveillance systems and disease reporting, it's been a lot better. And part of that is because of the integration, because of influenza in particular, that we understand that we need to have surveillance systems in animals as well as our environment. Developing and using diagnostics, great technological advances that work both for animals and for environmental sampling. Educating an infectious disease workforce, fair. Vaccine development, this is the decade of the vaccine. In many instances, okay, but more to come. New antimicrobial drugs, dismal. It's poor. The pipeline's almost dry. The cost of actually producing new antimicrobial agents is such that we don't really have much coming into the pipeline. And for those that we do have, we're not using them very well. And antimicrobial resistance is becoming a huge problem, not just in this country, but especially globally, as I think one of the driving problems in the next decade. Vector-borne and disease control, we're learning as we look at dengue and some real problems with vector-borne diseases as we move into the future. Comprehensive research portfolio, fair. My compliments to Gates Foundation, who now have grand challenges in One Health, the National Science Foundation, and State Department, and you're going to hear about some of those studies. Interdisciplinary centers starting to come together, especially in the academic worlds. So what are our lessons learned? So what happened in these last 20 or 30 years? What have we learned to move forward? About integrating surveillance activities. It's too late if you're just counting the number of human cases. We have to move things upstream. And shifting upstream closer to the problems, and the problems are likely in the environment or in the animal populations, that's where the intervention strategies should go. Risk-based approach to detection, the human-animal interface. Rapid and accurate, inexpensive diagnosis in real time. We're making some really good strides there. addressing the antimicrobial resistance issue. As a veterinarian, I will tell you, and somebody who's worked at CDC, I believe this is the single most pervasive wedge that is pushing animal health and human health apart. And until we actually address this and put our history behind us and look at, building new common ground, we're not going to get ahead of this game. Refocusing this strategy for that bottom 1 billion who is depending on livestock, and zoonotic diseases to them not only are a threat to them, but it's a threat to their economic well-being. And we need to start investing in pandemics, not every time that they happen. Just like this is a new occurrence, they're called, these are surprises that really aren't surprises. But we know they're going to happen. And look at the long-term strategies that we don't reinvent a strategy every time we have a new outbreak. Develop an integrated ecological and One Health research teams. You're going to hear from my colleagues, work that they've done and done just that. And that recognition today that what is really good for public health can come through good animal health and environmental health, and then realize this decade. So we'll close with, I think, some positive things. Great improvements in great technology. Food safety has improved, but I think it's going to be more of a threat as we see food systems grow internationally, a shift to kind of prevention and looking at predictions and hotspots, and the international health regulations now include zoonotic diseases in terms of reporting and response systems. A lot more talk about One Health, a lot more study, a lot more engagement, a shift to the idea of ecological emerging infectious diseases, and the integration of these systems. So the final slide is, think what happened in 2002 or before as we knew about emerging infectious diseases, and just compare where we are kind of today and where we're going to move into the future. So here's 2022, more about demographics and human behavior, more about more industry and trade, economic development and land use, more increases. International travel is not going to stop. It's going to move forward. Microbial adaptation and change, we're giving the microbes more opportunities with greater populations. A breakdown in public health measures, it's a real concern as money becomes scarce. Climate change and weather, we're still kind of predicting on what's going to happen there. Ecosystems changing, habitats changing, certainly poverty, war, and famine. So the very factors that started this whole idea of emerging infectious diseases have accelerated, intensified, and are more of a problem today than any time into our future. So we wake up this morning with these problems, back to the future, from MERS to influenzas, global antimicrobial resistance, urban agriculture, lack of investment, and a human biomass which is 100 times greater than any other mammal in the history of mankind, except for the cattle that we actually produce for ourselves. And that is out of balance.